Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
How you dare? Ty Roxon here. And today's guest is Karen Jaw Madsen. What a phenomenal guest. We talked about a lot of things. We talked about her background as an expat, her background as an immigrant, and what she does with her book, her amazing book. I read this book in 2 days, Culture Your Culture. How she really goes into companies to help them define what their organization culture is, why that is so important, and how that plays a role into the profits and the growth and development of your people. There is so much to glean in here. This is about an hour worth of content, so you can imagine just how much we dove into. But the big thing that we dove into was her process, which is DOWE, D-O-W-E. Really want you all to think about this, especially if you're someone just starting a startup. How do you create a company culture that sustains itself? If you're someone that is already an established company, how can you, as a manager, as a leader, as a colleague, end up working to reorganize your company culture so that it's one that retains people and makes people feel more engaged? All that is discussed. Please check out the episode. But before we dive into the episode, here's today's sponsor. Now, when it comes to business, you're the boss, and it's tough running the day-to-day and making sure that there is enough money to pay the bills. That's where Plastiq comes into play. They can help you keep your business cash flow running smoothly. Plastiq is a service that makes it possible to pay bills like rent, tuition, and mortgage payments, and even invoices by credit card when you ordinarily wouldn't. Seriously, you can pay virtually any business expense with a credit card, from suppliers to employers to your commercial lease. And here's the kicker. You're still earning cash back, points, and rewards every time you use Plastiq. Once you open a free account, just add a credit card, enter your mortgage or bill details, schedule a payment, and you're done. You're done. Plastiq will send a check to your mortgage company or bill servicer and charge the expense to your credit card. Et voila, your rewards are underway. So if you want to take advantage of this, all you need to do is go to plastiq.com/nomads. That's plastiq.com/nomads. That's plastiq.com/nomads. Go to plastiq.com/nomads. And when you sign up and make your first payment up to $1,000, Plastiq will waive the transaction fee. That's plastiq.com/nomads. Enjoy the episode.
In a world where very few people embrace their global identity and seek to understand their neighbors, cross-cultural expert Tayo Roxon is on a mission to bridge this divide. Each week, he'll open your mind with insights from some of the global minds in the world. Get ready, take some notes, and learn how to be the best you that you can be.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads. And today's guest is Karen Jaw Madsen, someone I have a lot in common with. Now, she is an organizational expert and author of Culture Your Culture, Innovating Experiences at Work. She enjoyed success as a corporate executive before pursuing a portfolio career comprised of research, writing, consulting, teaching, speaking, and creative pursuits. Proven her versatility across multiple industries, Karen developed, led, and implemented numerous organizational initiatives around the globe. She built a reputation as a strategic leader who gets things done. Today, she is an East Coast transplant in Silicon Valley. She betrayed us. And she's the principal of co-design of work experience. And we're going to be talking about what she means by culture to culture and how to create innovating experiences at work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
Pleasure is mine. This is it's always interesting. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, but I was telling you before the show and yesterday when we talked, it's always an extra pleasure when you feel like you can instantly connect with a person. Sounds like we have a lot of similar backgrounds, but also we essentially do the same sort of things with companies. And I'm so interested in diving into why you even got started in this line of work in the first place.
Yeah, so many connection points, and I think we share a lot personally and professionally. So it'd be interesting to see where this goes.
Absolutely. Well, peel us back and take us to, I guess, your early days. Let us know what family life was like and what those defining moments were for you, because I imagine you've had quite the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I am a child of immigrants. My parents came from Taiwan. I was born in the U.S., in New Jersey, in fact. Yeah. And I grew up moving around a lot because of my father's job as a Methodist pastor. And growing up in New Jersey in the 1980s was an interesting time as an Asian American, because really in the schools that I ended up in, you're either black or white and nothing in between, right? So I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me. I didn't grow up with a lot of people that looked like me, but it raised a lot of questions because I observed how my parents were treated and how I experienced my education as a child that didn't really quite fit in into any bucket. And I started to pride myself in that, in fact. So when it came to high school, trying to discover my own identity and understand where it comes from. I had all these questions growing up as to why is it that things are the way they are? And that eventually bubbled up into personal identity, which kind of led to my work in college in cultural and ethnic studies. Wow. So this whole theme of culture has been a common thread throughout my life. It really had a lot of moments and experiences seeing discrimination firsthand, and connecting with other people of color, because there wasn't any other people that were just like me. And I had wonderful experiences and connection points with people by virtue of the challenges that we dealt with. So I'm very grateful for the experiences I've had that led me and started my journey to the work I do today in terms of trying to make a difference in organizations and the cultures within them. We spend so much time at work. And it's so important to understand why things are the way they are and how we can manage them for the better.
That's incredible. And I love asking the guests that question where they take us back to the early days, because there's usually a crisis of identity that happens sometimes when you determine who you're going to be. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And so much of life is about, who you are and the gap between who you are and who you want to be. And a lot of times, for people that grew up in a similar background the way we did, when you find yourself mired in differences and people that look differently from you, it could go one of many ways where, you end up on several ends of the spectrum. But it sounds to me like you, at some point, figured out how to embrace your identity as someone who was always going to stick out. And that is a fascinating thing for me, because a lot of the listeners, they do identify with several cultures, but one of the things that they deal with is the identity crisis and wanting to be, to fit in, essentially.
Yeah.
So what was different for you?
For me, I had to embrace my intersectionality. So I'm not just a female, I'm also a person of color. I'm not just a U.S. citizen, but a child of immigrants. There's so many pieces that you can't, even if those identities come in conflict with each other, you somehow have to reconcile saying I'm both those things and expect from other people that they give you that space. So what I've always told people in the work I've done around diversity and also ethnic identity is you've got to figure that stuff out for yourself, or it's going to be done for you. Right. So you've got to build your identity, know who you are and figure out who you're going to be, because believe me, there's going to be plenty of other people that are going to try to peg you. And you it's better you peg yourself before you get pegged by other people. So it's a form of self-empowerment in a way. I've had conversations where I've been told you need to pick one, and I stand at the bridge between places, and I decided that's the role I'm going to play. I'm going to make those connection points. Mm. And so once people tried to push me into one direction, I actually resisted, and I give a lot of credit to my upbringing and an understanding of what my values were and are today, and what's not going to change no matter what.
Yeah. And that's the crazy thing. I was saying that we have a lot of things in common, and it's the same sort of thing. I had to figure out a way where people would tell me, you're not Nigerian enough, you're not this enough, you're not that enough, you sound like this, you don't sound like, we don't feel like we can put you in a box. And that was initially frustrating because it wasn't just coming from strangers. It came from, like, you know, people, you know, your extended family.
Your kins.
Kins, your friends. And I was like, it's the same sort of thing. When the podcast came about, when I decided to do this, I was like, I have to figure out a way to bridge all these cultural divides. I feel like this is essentially what I was placed on earth to do. And it wasn't a mistake that I was always there. And I think that realization of understanding the intersectionality that exists within you and being okay with the fact that it's okay to be multiple things and not necessarily a binary thing is probably a very freeing feeling to have.
Yeah, it's a form of, you know, taking back the power in a way. And so that's what makes you special. That's what makes you unique, you know. And we talk about being able to find our space and creating. If it doesn't exist, we got to create it, you know.
Yeah.
We got to make room for ourselves, because who's going to be a better advocate than ourselves, right?
Right.
And that's something that I think the social structures around us don't always allow for or want, and you have to kind of fight your way through it. So it takes a lot of tenacity to work through personal identity and then finding our place in this world. But it's totally worth it once you get there, right?
That's 100% correct. Now, talk to me about that transition. You know, so now you had a strong sense of self. You decided to start, you know, getting into the work field, and your career, your 20-year career, which is incredible. Your 20-year career includes a lot of things, though. But you've been an expat, independent consultant, HR director. You've led development and implementation in many, many, many companies. How did you realize what your career path was going to be like?
You know, I have quite an interesting career path. When I graduated from college, my first thing was, I'm going to become a professor in ethnic studies. That was my thing, because we were fighting so hard to have ethnic studies part of the college curriculums, and I wanted to be part of that. But I moved to California the first time to pursue that graduate school. I needed to establish residency first. And so I started working in the nonprofit field and in working for journalists of color, which was great. I got exposure to so many wonderful people. And what ended up happening there was I caught somebody's attention, a consultant who pulled me aside and said, "Hey, I've been watching you, and I know you've got this path you're pursuing on becoming a professor and earning your PhD and all that." But he goes, "You can always go back to doing that. I really see you having an impact in organizations. Just give a think on it." And the fact that he took that time to pull me aside and to disrupt my thinking, it really took my attention, and I had to think about that. So when I actually got into grad school on the East Coast, I decided to come back home and pursue work outside a nonprofit in the corporate space. And that's how I ended up at Lockheed Martin.
Wow.
And that's where it went from there. So once I got to Lockheed Martin, it was a path in HR. And I'll tell you all the shifting points, because I moved my way up over time and had greater scope of responsibility and met awesome people and did awesome projects along the way. And then I got to the level and the role where I realized I didn't want my boss's job. So I was reporting to the CHRO, and I got close enough to know that the path I was pursuing was actually not going to be right for me. So that was another turning point, and I needed to figure out what that meant and how I needed to lead my life a little bit differently from there. And that's how I ended up where I am today.
You're incredibly self-aware. And that's what I'm getting from there, because we talk about you in the early stages. You talk about the fact that you came to terms with the idea that you're owning your identity and all that it entails, the intersectionality. And now you talk about rising up to pretty much near the top, and then you realizing early, you realizing like this is not the job that you want. That particular point in people's lives is when, you know, people might be married, they've bought a house, they bought a mortgage, they have kids, and they have to decide. They know internally there's a voice telling them this doesn't work. But then the attraction of a higher job with a higher salary is too alluring for them to turn down. And yep. A lot of people stay.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do the opposite?
They do. why did I decide to start all over again?
Yeah, you started all over again. And then talk to me about that process, but also talk to me about what you learned about yourself and why you felt so called to actually do that.
You know, in such a short time, I tell you, it's as if it all happened very quickly, but it really didn't, right? It took me a year to question things and then another year to figure out when I wanted to move on. So it was really about doing a lot of reflection and trying to incorporate all the learning I had. And you'll see how some of these personal experiences have influenced my work with Culture Your Culture, because I realized that I needed to be iterative in the way I learned. And sometimes, even if I didn't know the answer, I didn't say, okay, I'm going to pursue a portfolio career overnight. I had to iterate on that. I had to reflect, and I had to reincorporate in new information to figure out where I'm going. And this self-awareness, which is really trying to look at yourself impartially, trying to take a look at oneself and saying, okay, if I were advising somebody in my situation, what would I do? And you're right. Some people don't take that leap. To me, it was more of a prison to stay where I was, yeah. Right? To stay the path, because there was a dissonance in my heart, right? So I did what I did really well, and it didn't feel right anymore. And to keep going to me wasn't going to be honest. It was very scary, but I prepared, because it took so long to figure it out, I prepared a nest egg to say, okay, what's going to tie me over until I get reestablished? It included another move to cross country. And to me, it was more of a risk to stay where I was than to take that leap of faith. Yeah. Now, I got a lot of interesting comments from people as I was making this change. I got some, oh, you're so brave, but I would never do that. But what I've told people since is the reality of our sense of security isn't always what we think it is, right? So working for a company in a steady job and getting a steady paycheck, that stuff can be taken away from you overnight. So it's not really as secure as people think it is. And becoming my own boss, as scary as it was extremely liberating. I joke to people, I say, I really love my new boss. And yeah. I always got along with my bosses. but here is a situation where the only person I was accountable to was me, and that was probably the most important person I needed to do that for.
That's 100% true. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So it's been quite a journey. I'm still learning through it, and I'm still coming to the full realization of that. This has only been 5 years long, and I would never. I would look back and I said I wouldn't do anything different, and I want to keep going and seeing where this goes. I'm open to the possibilities.
That's incredible and so brave, and I love that story. And I know people said that that's a brave thing for you to do, but the reason why I understand why people say that, because people said the same thing to me, is because of what you said. It's the idea of leaving something that seems to give you a sense of security, the idea of the possibility of failing, mm-hmm. of you starting over, of what people will think, of you not, you just going from an expert level to beginning level, potentially. All these things run mm-hmm. through people's minds, but it ultimately led to an incredible book that I'm almost through, which is Culture Your Culture.
Yes.
Talk to me about the title. Culture Your Culture is such a catchy title, but what are you trying
Thanks.
To say? No, I love it. What are you trying to say to the world with this book?
Well, the name of the book is quite intentional, as is the methodology behind it, Design of Work Experience. Culture Your Culture, it really creates a sense of action. So it's double play on words, as you know. And when we say culture, your culture, there's a verb behind that, right? So we always talk about, or we sometimes blame culture as if it's this faraway thing, but it's something that's quite within our grasp to influence with the right tools. Mm-hmm. And so the purpose of this title is to be able to communicate that message, to bring culture that's something a little bit esoteric to people or intangible to them and make it real. And so I felt like this book needed to be written because there was far more work to be done than what I could do alone.
Right.
And it's a different way of looking at things. As I was pitching this, this is not your typical business book. You know, the whole point of it is innovating experiences at work. So, you know, if you want different results, you got to try different things. That's what I tell people. and I had something different to say. So that's really why I wrote this book. And it's the same thing. It's the same way I act in meetings. You know, I don't really say anything unless I have something to contribute of value. And I really felt strongly, we don't write books here for money anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have something to say and something to share and something to contribute. And that's why I wrote the book.
Well, yeah, you do have something to say. You have quite a lot to say. I mean, if you talk about ways people can define a company culture, and you also created a concept called DOWE, D-O-W-E, and we're going to dive into that. But I want to start off with the company culture aspect, because this is what's going on in the world. I mean, you know this more than anyone. Mm-hmm. Digitalization, globalization. So with digitalization, you got more flexible workplaces, but you also have, you know, people come into contact with people from different parts of the world. Globalization is the same sort of thing. You're coming into contact with different ways people do businesses, different ideas, and these things can then come, you know, can cause such a disruption if you don't have a defined company culture. And a lot of times what happens with companies, especially fast growing startups, we saw what Uber is, they focus so much on the profits that they neglect the company culture. And what happens is people aren't happy, but on the outside, it looks like you're making $6 billion. And their cycle continues to exist. Then you get the Me Too's, the Me Too movements, and the Time's Up, mm-hmm. which is a very, very, I'm so happy the movements like that are happening because.
Me
these,
too.
Yeah, because these things have happened.
Pun intended.
Yes, Me Too, pun intended. Because these things have happened, but how do we get leaders and managers to understand how to create a consistent company culture so they don't have to just be making things up as they go, given all the changes that our world is currently facing?
Yeah. I think part of it is they haven't been paying attention, right? So when these things blow up, it's kind of as if the company was caught unawares, even though us from the outside could see it coming from a million miles away, right?
Right.
We realize now, I mean, there's enough data out there to say culture matters. It has a huge impact on the success or failures in business. The companies that are doing well and are failing at culture, they're making money in spite of themselves, and they're losing a lot of potential in their business that they don't realize. The other thing is that, you know, we talk about let's change things and then just trial and error our way in it. And it's one thing to be iterative intentionally. It's another thing to be like kind of shooting in the dark, as some companies do. So that's why I created this framework. It was really born out of a frustration with how often we raise culture as a huge factor for these companies after the fact. And yet there was no step-by-step how-to for intentionally creating culture on the front end. So what DOWE does is pulls together what's required to meet this unmet need.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. And it brings business strategies, company values, and culture to life at an organization. How does it work?
Yeah. And lots of examples. Yeah. And I can talk about that. But just to finish my last point, there are a lot of examples of companies that do especially well because of their culture, right? Mm. And so it's really important to know that when context changes, culture should be at the forefront of what a company does. And you talk about all this disruption that's constantly happening. So this organizational self-awareness needs to be there when it comes to culture. Wow. So yeah. Yeah. So let me talk about, to answer your other questions around the DOWE model. The model is a combination of design and change processes enabled by engagement and capability throughout. So these are arranged as a series of five phases, each of them with progressive learning loops of specific activities that really enable a company to design, implement, and sustain culture. So it works at different altitudes, but at the highest altitude, you can see where these four components come together, and then you really get to know how it works experientially. So there's only so much, I even say this in my writing, is there's only so much you can learn about from reading about it. The true appreciation for how this works is through experience.
Yeah. And for those listening, we're talking about, Karen's process here, which is Dewey, and D-O-W-E. But the process combines and is comprised of four major components. You just heard her talk about them: design, change, capability, and engagement. Now, design and change processes are enabled by leveraging and building capability and engagement. So it sounds to me like, and reading the book, you can't have one without the other. Especially, you can't do design without change, and there's no capability without the engagement. How do you?
Absolutely.
There you go. So I'm curious, and it's also the interesting thing about your Dewey model is that this is a co-creation, right?
Yes, it's a co-creation model. Because oftentimes when major changes happen in companies, there are these edicts from above, right, that get pushed down and pushed down poorly, let's just say, right? And oftentimes without consideration for where a company is today and where they want to go. So then everyone's scrambling to figure out how to get there. And it oftentimes comes with a lot of failures along the way as a result, and the loss of really good talent as well.
Yeah,
it becomes a distraction to a company, quite frankly, when, you know, sometimes when you implement change poorly, it's almost as if it's almost better as if you didn't do it at all, right? Because you end up being worse off than you were beforehand.
Yeah, no, and going through the book, you're such a creative writer. You have these loops.
Learning loops, yes.
Learning loops. And you can see how each of these things are connected, and you have to read the book to know what I'm saying. But there's a lot of, you know, the reason why I said we're like kindred spirits here, whenever I do a speech, which my signature speech is on connecting across cultures, I have a section where I talk about learning about your environment. And one of the things I talk about is how much I learned from my father as a diplomat to collect and gather information. That is a lot of what you're learning. You talk about that. You always say, figure out a way to encounter new information. How do you get information about what is the actual problem in your company without having your bias affect the information you're collecting?
Right. So you become researchers of your own environment. So the design process, it comes from design thinking. And what that kind of creates is a situation where you take the organization, and I recommend a team is set aside especially to help facilitate the process for the entire organization. But what that means is then we can become scientists of our anthropologists of our own environments, and we look at it in an impartial way to be able to understand the complexities behind it. So you become scientists in a way, right, when you're looking at something, as opposed to being pulled into your own biases. So there's a lot of mechanisms in this process that are meant to take the bias out of the process. Decision making is not based on who is the loudest voice in the room or what is most popular. Decision making is based on a set of criteria that's directly and derived from data. Wow. So yeah, and I know it's really hard to explain this from an auditory standpoint, but you know, the five phases can give you an idea of what somebody goes through when they do Dewey. So you understand first. Mm-hmm. There's learning loops around how do you understand your organization, where you are today. Create and learn. How do you design for the future iteratively? How do you make a decision after that? So that decide is the third phase. Okay, once you decide, how do you plan for it? That's the next phase. And then the last phase is implement. And that ends with what you're going to do to sustain it over time. So there is a journey there that I think a lot of people are accustomed to with other changes. But because they're organized as a series of learning loops, it's iterative. And the framing is around learning. We're going to discover this together. We don't know the answers up front. We're going to figure it out together. We're going to co-create that future. Because guess what? We're all expected to adopt it, right? So wouldn't it be better if we who are going to be living this are part of creating it?
Yeah. And another thing to remember, something that I love that you said in the book is you talk about how many companies try to do this one size fits all strategy where, hey, we have a tragedy, something happened, our employer brand was affected, so we're going to do what worked in company X and apply it to us. And you talk about the importance of context and understanding how each of these environments are different. And so that's where your co-creation comes. It could be that worked for that company, but you won't be able to know for sure until you do the due diligence, which is to collect the information to then create a team of people that can work on what you found based on the information and then implement what you talked about.
I call that the best practice myth.
Best practice. Well, please go ahead with what that means.
Oh, well, the best practice myth comes from everyone's assumption that because it's best practice, it's going to be working successfully for our own organizations, right? So to your point that you were talking, every organization has its unique context, because guess what? We all have different people there, different businesses, different challenges, different cultures. And so taking a best practice wholesale and implementing it and expecting that it's going to work the same way across organizations is a fallacy. The skill is not about picking which solution is going to work so much as the right combination of solutions with a deep understanding of how those are going to work in the mechanisms of the organization. So that's the best practice myth is, you know, and there's a lot of books out there around how I did it, right?
Yeah. This
is how you do culture because this is how my company did it. And there's a lot to be learned out of those, but the skill is in translating that to our own context. And we can only do that when we understand ourselves.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Thoroughly.
Yeah.
And so that's what I argue about, because I've seen this time and time again. Organizations don't learn, right? They take something and they say, oh, that didn't work, so therefore the whole thing is wrong. Well, that's not true. It's about how it's implemented. You know, we have another after action review and we keep talking about the same thing going wrong. Our organization's not learning, right? Because learning is defined by change behavior.
Yeah.
So that's why all of this is organized as a series of learning loops, with the intention that we will continue to build upon what we know and work toward that outcome.
Yeah, perfect. That's perfectly said. That's amazing, and I love that. Best practice.
Oh, thank you.
No, it's true.
Yes.
I mean, we can look no shortage to any company in the past 2 years alone where, you know, certain things have happened. If it's even, it could go from as big as Facebook to Uber to H&M to, you know, companies that we've grown to, you know, to love, and you hear about these things where...
Or love to hate.
Yeah, love to hate, right? And then you hear about these Pepsi last year, you hear about all these things and you wonder how those decisions were made. And it's always interesting when the results come out, and it is what you said, they didn't actually co-create. These decisions got to a certain point and someone said, this is a good idea, who didn't necessarily have a good idea of
the whole picture.
Yeah, the full picture. There you go.
We're not leveraging the talent of the whole community when that happens.
Yeah, but you've worked in corporate environments. Can you tell me why that happens? Let's look at Pepsi, for example. Pepsi is an amazing company that's been around for the longest times. They've been involved in Cold Wars and everything. But then when you put, I forget which Jenner, I think it was Kendall. Yeah. As the face of like a black, you're trying to talk about Black Lives Matter and you're doing that. Now, yes, intention is great, but then that screams is tone deaf. But how do you, you know, this is what I'm saying. How does that happen where you're such a reputable company? You haven't had as many of the other public disasters as other companies have had, but how does that slip one's mind? That's what I'm always curious about.
Well, you know, what it boils down to is a lack of empathy, to be honest, right? Mm. So if there was a full understanding of Black Lives Matter and what that means to the people of that movement and the communities that affects, you look at it and you say that commercial would never run, right? And the question is, were the voices heard? Because PepsiCo is a very large organization. I'm sure there would have been people in that organization that might have had a different view of it. But sometimes in organizations, decisions are made by the power granted in someone's role or position or degree of influence granted by role or position, right? And so the onus is on the leaders in those roles, because we know that organizations work hierarchically many times. And so the onus is on the leaders in those organizations to be able to listen and to not be so arrogant that they wouldn't hear other perspectives or seek other perspectives and engage with people who may know more than them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true leadership, isn't it? Is to have every leader needs followers. Right.
That's true. It's how you determine that, you know, you're an effective
leader. The strength
of
leadership. Yeah. So the question is, are organizations learning from this? So anytime something bad happens, so the question is, did Pepsi learn from that? Did it change their direction? Did it create a teaching moment for the organization to say, you know, what were the conditions that created that outcome? And what can we do to intentionally create conditions when that would never happen?
Right. That's no, I love it. I agree completely. And okay, to move on with the process, engagement, mm-hmm. employee engagement, it's a big deal. You touched on it earlier. We work for most of our lives. It's either school or work. And so, so essentially, ideally, your situation is you should be able to bring at least your whole self to work. And a lot of times, if you're not fully engaged, it affects your productivity and your capability to do your work. And
absolutely.
Exactly. And what that leads to is what success companies could experience. So how can companies increase their engagement?
That's why a culture plays such a huge role in engagement, right? Because it's that environment that shapes people's perceptions and behaviors. And so it's in every company's best interest to create those environments, those cultures where people thrive, right? That people are inspired and productive. And there's this concept in positive psychology called flow, where people just are so immersed and inspired in the work that they're doing that they lose track of time, you know, because they're so passionate about it. And the thing is, we are coded as humans to want to learn. Want to make a difference. That goes across cultures.
And it's
like a company's best interest to be able to figure out how to get that combination. Where how do you set up the conditions where as many people or the right people are inspired to do their best work? Because that's when the company is going to be successful.
And it's something that leaders can't forget as they grow. You know,
well, that's it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So you talk about when, you know, what's in the news today is Papa John's.
Papa John's.
Papa John's CEO, the founder, you know, I'm guessing he's a different person today than he was when he first founded the company.
I would,
that's okay.
Yeah.
We evolve. But the question is, how much self-examination was made around the impact of that founder's personality in the culture of that organization? Because there is such a huge tendency in founder-led organizations to mimic their personality, for better or worse.
And
now we're hearing that there's a toxic culture there that's just coming out now because of what's happened with him. And, you know, this has been going on for years. It didn't happen overnight. This was created. And so when we're perfectly designed, David Cooperrider says we're perfectly designed for our current results. Dewey is here to help you design for different results.
That's right. And what your system does, your framework does, is that it helps diagnose potential problems and allows you all to work on ways to create those meaningful experiences, but to make sure that you go from demotivation to motivation. And with Papa John's, it's such a look. Papa John's, everyone know, I watch sports all the time. They've been such a mainstay with the NFL and all these mm-hmm. other companies. You never would have said, I mean, he's a smiley guy or whatever. It's easy for us on the outside to say, oh, yeah, you know, seems like whatever. and then one thing comes out. And then
a
snowball effect. This happens with the Me Too movement. This happens with Uber. This happens all that. And that is the importance of having a stable culture. Now, it would have been a different thing. It would have been a different thing if he did something that was uncharacteristic and people would have said, no, that's not the case. He's a little, I mean, this was a slip. This was not what, you know, this is just an anomaly. That's what happens when you have a strong culture.
Right.
Yeah.
The narrative just reinforces it now, right? Instead of defending him, because, you know, when you don't intentionally manage culture, it's going to manage you. Mm. Right. Mm. So now this company is a victim of its own culture, one that was guided by a founder that is no longer there. Wow. So what do they do now? Right. And so instead of allowing that to be a situation that breaks a business, it can be, everyone loves a turnaround story. So it's a wonderful opportunity for them to forge a new path.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I love this stuff. This is,
I completely geek out. I love talking with you about it.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the time. So mistakes. We've been talking about mistakes. Yeah. How can companies then avoid, managers and leaders avoid mistakes when they're trying to change something that they offer to the public? You know, how do they handle that?
Oh, so you mean changes in brand or service
like offering? Yeah, a shift in service or like product offerings, that's tricky.
I think the companies that see their customers as a part of their organization are onto something. Because when they consider them a part of that, then they're going to manage it a little bit differently. And so this whole change management, these all best practices or these how-tos on change management, I mean, there's things we know about how to do change management well. And we do them within our organizations sometimes. The same people that work for your organizations are also consumers, aren't they? And so, or customers, right, of other or have worked for other companies that were customers. And so it's really important to be able to manage change similarly, engaging, you know, customers on impending changes, getting their input, you know, setting the conditions where they understand the narrative that's being created, you know, what's going to be staying the same versus what's changing, because that's the scariest part. And building that psychological safety for people so that change is something that's welcomed as opposed to feared. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of these practices around how do you do change management that oftentimes don't get extended to customers, and they should be.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh.
It's a little different view, isn't it?
No, but it's a good and refreshing view. And first of all, this also, we're talking about how to deal with changes, but you know, you have to have that relationship. But this also goes with something I read that you said, was we talk about diversity and inclusion. You can recruit until the cows come home for diversity. Yes. But if you don't have the conditions for diversity to thrive, it's going to fall. And so it's all.
I'm so frustrated by that.
No, well, I run a diversity and inclusion firm, and a lot of the things that I hear is, you know, I hear everything from, I don't know where to find people of color or people of talent, that, you know, it's dry, or we hired a few people, they didn't stay, or they weren't qualified, and I don't want to do, you know, so, and I think people turn into like affirmative actions or like they try to just, I'll just find someone that looks the part without actually, you know.
Let's fit the quotas in.
Yeah, like it becomes a quota, and I'm like, wow, you're missing the complete point. And and it's hard.
Not to, leveraging it.
Yeah. But it's hard to explain that to sometimes to people that are only thinking dollars and cents and immediate dollars and cents. Like, how much money can this make me? How much time is this costing me? And when you're not able to see the long-term vision for it, it's tough. But it's also tougher when you have a leader who doesn't necessarily share the values of the people they lead. That to me has been the toughest. Where I know, and I, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this too, where you assess a company, you do all the surveys and everything. They want more, they want to be able to see themselves in leadership positions, and the leader is like, what are you talking about? And it's tough when you have two competing ideals there. And I'm just curious about your experience with those type of frustrating situations and what you've done in those moments.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head in terms of kind of short-term gain versus long-term. Because at the end of the day, if you don't know how to leverage diversity, you are going to lose money. You're not going to get the benefits out of it. And there is, we live in an age now that the excuse of ignorance is no longer valid. No one can say that anymore.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's in organizations that they need to be able to take a good, hard look at themselves culturally to say, are we an environment where diversity is going to thrive? And if it's not, then what needs to be changed in order to make it that way? Because I can't tell you, I stopped going to diversity events because all it was about was recruiting.
Yeah.
And it was so frustrating for me because, especially here in Silicon Valley, you know, just releasing the numbers, which is, I love that there's a transparency there now and a willingness to have accountability around it. But they're not looking at the full picture if they're not creating those teams where diversity is fully leveraged, right? So you and I are in the business where we get calls, right? And we might get a call that says, you know, we keep failing at our diversity initiatives. Help. Why is this not working? We've had a lot of starts and stops, and now everyone's feeling bitter about it. And one of the first things I do is level set these organizations, because what they don't understand is their diversity problem is a cultural problem. So culture is the kind of the thing that's behind everything else, right? So you can't just address diversity and not the culture and expect things to work. Right, you can't just say we need a culture of diversity. It's just culture. It's the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. So a culture of safety, or you know, a culture of lean, whatever you want to call it. But these characteristics that people try to say we need a culture of X, Y, or Z, that's an unrealistic expectation, because that's really not how life is lived. Culture exists as a whole, right? So you can't just say I'm going to fix this part of the culture. It's culture, right? So if diversity is a challenge, it's also a culture issue,
right?
So when I go into organizations to talk with them about diversity, it becomes a culture discussion because they are not setting the environments where that culture is receptive to diversity.
Yeah.
What, intentional or not, right? I know everyone has the best intentions when it comes to diversity, so it's not a judgment on people. They're not bad people as a result, because they're well-intentioned, but they maybe don't understand the mechanisms that are influencing their outcomes.
Yeah.
And that's why what Dewey does is force this deep dive into self-awareness. And a company has to be open to that in order to do this successfully, right? So what I tell people is, if you gotta, the first thing is leadership has to be behind it. You have to have a business reason for caring about culture, and you have to care about people. And if you don't have those, then, you know, this isn't really going to work for them.
100%. And we're talking to Karen Jaw Madsen, the author of this amazing book called Culture Your Culture.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it's she's talking about how it's really not like your typical business book. It really isn't, because it's very, very practical. It's not necessarily full of case studies, but it's more about just how you, it's like I liken it to having a relationship with someone, or making a new friend in a foreign environment, and the person is guiding you like, hey, here's what you need to watch out for, here's how you need to do that. And that's exactly what it is. It's something that can be applicable to many situations, but it gives you agency.
I like that.
Yeah, it gives you agency. agency to do what you want.
Yeah, and you know, I've had a lot of international experience where, you know, I've been able to observe you know, how different environments function in different national cultures. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we're all learners, we're human beings, so we want to learn, we're sponges, you know, and we are creatures or products of our own experiences. And we all want to be able to do a good job and make a difference. That I truly believe that, and that crosses cultures. There's nothing like this to bring a company closer together. And there has been research that says if a company's culture is so, it can be so strong that it becomes more salient than the differences that come from national culture. And that's really important for multinational corporations or companies that do business all around the world, is to be able to say, okay, we need to be so overt about this so that's really clear and everyone understands and has the expectations around it. Okay. Yeah, but I really, really hope that this is something that people can think about adopting because I know it works. And I think it's so desperately needed. And it's not just in the U.S. I think it's around the world. And people have different perceptions of, you know, other topics like diversity. I learned that that's seen very differently, particularly in Europe.
Very, very.
Exactly. And you know, it's so funny being an expat and being kind of the resident American expert because they'd be like, what is up with this? Yeah. Corporate is pushing this diversity training down to us and we really don't understand what the big deal is all about because, you know, I think we in America don't do a good enough job of explaining ourselves to people. So I think there's a lot to be done in the culture space and I hope this makes a difference.
It does. No, that's why I like the fact that the book doesn't necessarily say this is what you need to do. It's more about telling you why it works and how you can apply it. And, you know, you're giving people say, hey, you got, when you form a team, look for these type of people, collect this type of information, take that, gather that. You're teaching people how to be researchers, how to be learners and how to actually create that habit. And that's, if you think of, I always talk about in our field, the people I study are, you know, I study, you know, diplomats, detectives, you know, anthropologists, you know, all these people, psychologists, people that are or sociologists, and all those people that have to think and critically think through certain ways before you come up with something to create a framework, because you have to have that type of mindset where you're able to be agile with different environments. And I think sometimes with leaders, you know, we're so taught to like, you know, have this result-oriented thing to happen immediately. We sometimes forget, you know, that we're dealing with different types of people.
Right. They're not seeing the forest through the trees, clearly. And then we're always focused on what's happening next instead of paying attention to what's in front of us. So this whole concept. Right. So this whole concept of being mindful and reflecting on our learnings is going to make our future that much better, you know? But we often don't pay attention and then we're caught unawares. So there's lots of examples of lessons learned because people are not paying attention.
But we're getting ready to wrap up soon, but I want to ask you, this has been, I can talk all day. But
me too.
That's good to hear. It's good to hear. But I want to talk about, I want to, you know, have a portion for the skeptics, for example. So
yes, there are those.
Yeah, they are. They are many in our field. And look, there, you know, might be people that feel like this is creating a PC culture, right? Or like this is, oh, what about free speech? I can't, you know, I can't joke, you know, I can't say this, or she's being way too sensitive, or this is, you know, we're not doing any of that stuff. How do you deal with leaders that think that way? And employees that find themselves in a position where, well, they don't want to quit because they need the money. I'm saying this because I've actually witnessed this where they hate the job. They feel like it's a misogynist culture or sexist or something that's not in tune with their values, but they know that their CEO or leaders don't think the same way they think. We even saw this during the elections, regardless of where you fall. I remember after elections, I got a lot of calls around, I don't know, these people don't know how to work together anymore. You know, someone said something and it's really affecting people's identity because they feel like, what's going on? And then you have people saying, you're a snowflake or identity politics. How do you deal with those things? Because those are outside things that people bring into the workforce, which you could say it's ultimately part of who you are. How do you deal with that when there's such a divide.
Right. People come with a lot of baggage, don't they?
Yes.
Well, let me break that up into a few different pieces. When I'm working with individuals and they're in that situation where they find themselves in a work environment that is demotivating to them, I do two things. I really try to help them to figure out what they can influence within their power. So because oftentimes in these situations, there's a sense of powerlessness. And to your point, also a loss of self-esteem. If you're in an environment that is eating at you every day, then there's an impact to your well-being as a result of that. And so the first thing I try to do in those situations is to help somebody to find whatever empowerment they can find in their situations. And after that, the second thing would be to ask the question, to provoke them to think it through, is this company worthy of your talent?
Boom.
Because if it's not, then why are you giving it to them, you know? And a lot of times it's about helping somebody build the confidence that they need to move on, because what I want to do is help them get excited for what's next, that this is a learning, what they've gone through, and it's prepared them for what they're going to do next. So I want to get them to that next point as quickly as possible. Now, when it comes to those that don't get it, let's just say that's a diplomatic, nicer way of saying it.
I was trying.
I think that needs to be broken down to making them open. So not trying to piece by piece deconstruct every single bias that they have or misconception, is to just work on getting an openness. Because my first question to those people are, how's it working out for you? Right? Because chances are it's not.
Yeah.
And or there's something wrong, right? That's why they're having the conversation with me. And so to try to get them to that place where they're open and willing to learn, they will be able to pull out those mental models that are getting in their way, or those mental blocks, I should say.
Yeah.
They will self-identify where they've been wrong in their perspective, or where they've had a bias that's changed the way they've seen things. So for me, it's about helping those skeptics get that openness. Now, if the openness is, there's no openness to openness, then we can't really help them, right? They have to learn by experience. But if there's a willingness to be open, then it becomes a development, a capability building to help them be able to identify that for themselves, where they have gone wrong, as opposed to me sitting there judging them and telling them, you did this wrong, you did that right, right?
Yeah.
You want to give them the tools to be able to become the leaders that they always wanted to be.
Well said. No, well said. And yeah, I mean, sometimes when I have talks with CEOs, I always say, okay, let's look at the scenario. We can all agree that people are unhappy.
Right.
Another thing that I can say is, you probably don't want to fire everyone, even though you might feel like it, because there's a lot of that. So what do we do? And then they're like, all right, fine, we got to do this. But it's sort of creating that scenario where, okay, you feel this way, other people feel this way, but there has to be somewhere you can understand how this is detrimental to your ultimate goal, which is your company, mm-hmm. the profitability of your company. And you know, it's a very delicate thing to do, but, you know, go ahead.
We've all experienced hardship in our lives. That has no, there's, I mean, even the wealthiest, the most successful people have challenges in their lives, right? That's indiscriminate. We all experience hardships. Now, part of our jobs, perhaps, as change leaders, is to use that to build empathy of other people's situations.
Yeah.
Because we've all had hardship. Now be able to think through, you know, what it is that creates why things the way they are, right? The whole culture conversation. And the fact that leaders who come with all this influence are creating and influencing that knowingly or not. So, but have you, you know, when it comes to this diversity discussion, you know, that book, So You Want to Talk About Race? Mm-hmm. I feel has been so helpful.
What's it called again?
So You Want to Talk About Race.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I read it.
It's a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah,
you know?
I did. I was like, you're so right. I actually did read it. Read it 2 months ago. Wow, yeah.
Don't you think that really helps with the dialogue? I really feel like that makes a difference. I mean, for me as a person of color, it finally gave me the words to explain what I'm trying to express sometimes.
Yeah.
And then for people that are not, you know, or for others, it's about kind of building that empathy and understanding that these invisible structures, these social constructs, are having a huge influence on where we are today collectively as a community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's by Ijeoma Oluwa. And the reason why I resonate with the book is because she's half Nigerian. I'm Nigerian. And I understood a lot what she was saying. But that book, and also there's a book by Francesca Ramsey called Well, That Escalated Quickly. It also talks about this. And so... you know, it comes onto what you said earlier. This thing is a learning thing. We have to be constantly learning about each other, and we can't have this mindset of like, oh, we've learned, we're adults now, and we have to stop. That's a fixed mindset, and we have to have a growth mindset The world is evolving, and it's just counterintuitive.
And the CEOs, unfortunately, you know, they've gotten so caught up in their own worlds, and they become so isolated. It's quite a lonely place to be sometimes.
For sure.
And, you know, I've asked a number of CEOs, you know, okay, you've gotten to the pinnacle of your career and where you wanted to go. What's next? And they don't have an answer all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
That's true.
And so I think we play roles where we can help connect to people. And if a leader in an organization feels disconnected from their employee body, you know, Dewey is a great way to bring that bridge that chasm, you know?
Well, I love it. What a way to end this, because we've been talking to the great Karen Jarre Madsen, and we've talked about a lot of different topics, you know, from her identity, embracing her identity, into getting into the field, you know, why she chose entrepreneurship, and why this book and the importance of this book. I always end my podcast with my mission statement, which is...
Right.
Yeah, no, it's framed in the form of a question. This is the reason I do what I do. So, Karen, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
How do I use my difference to make a difference?
Yeah.
I think, you know... I could die tomorrow happy that I finally got this book out. I mean, it was a long and arduous journey, because this is really my attempt. I try to make a difference with every person I touch every day, but I know that I can't touch a lot of people in mass. This book is a small way that I hope to do that. So I think for me it's not that I give people anything so much as I enable them. I want to be that person that makes a difference in their lives, because it's opened up new possibilities for them.
Right.
To me, it's not about what I can get out of it so much as, you know, if I can be, by being connected to somebody and helping them along in their journey, that to me is fulfillment.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. Being connected to somebody and helping them along with their journey. Wow. Well said. This has been a real pleasure. Obviously, I know that we're going to be talking way much more and beyond the podcast, but
yes, I'm looking forward to that too.
Looking forward to that as well. But thank you for spending the time with us and really educating us. I hope a lot of people get this book and also pass it on to their co-founders, their colleagues, their leaders, their friends, their daughters, mothers, sons. There's really a lot of value that can be, gleaned from this book. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here.
Pleasure is mine. And ladies and gentlemen, till next time, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.